Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, International Human Rights Day. In Strasbourg, Council of Europe ministers meet to discuss changing the framework of the European Convention on Human Rights in order to enable countries to crack down on migration. Meanwhile, in The Hague, the Dutch Foreign Ministry honours international human rights defenders with the prestigious Tulip Award. Also on the show, 30 years on, the Dayton Peace Agreement explained, plus the 22-year-old student tackling medical inequality via a platform enabling the identification of dermatological conditions across diverse skin tones. That is all coming up here on Inside Europe.
This organization was not created for fair weather. It was forged in the aftermath of the Second World War precisely to protect rights and dignity when times are hardest. And make no mistake, Europe is facing hard times right now. And that is exactly why this institution exists, and that is why this meeting matters.
Alain Berset, the Secretary General of the Council of Europe there, speaking in Strasbourg after ministers from all 46 member states backed plans to consider how the European Convention on Human Rights is applied in the light of the challenges posed by unauthorised migration.
Now about the European Convention on Human Rights, it is the constitutional bedrock of Europe's legal order. It is the ultimate safeguard of individual rights and freedoms for citizens across our continent. And it is also, and it was also said this morning, it is also a living instrument. It has guided us through periods of profound change. Let's think about just the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and every major transformation since 1950, and the new world order we are facing. The outcome of today's meeting is clear. Ministers have supported the four-point plan, and they called for the preparation of political declaration on migration and European Convention on Human Rights to be adopted in Chisinau, Moldova, in May 2026.
According to Agence France-Presse, at least 27 countries have now called for a rethink of the treaty's interpretation by the European Court of Human Rights. The decision came 6 months after 9 countries, including Italy, Denmark, Poland and Belgium, published a letter criticising the ECHR for setting, quote, too many limits on their power to expel people from their territories. At the heart of the debate are two key articles of the Convention, often used by those challenging deportation orders. Article 3 bans torture and inhumane or degrading treatment, and Article 8 protects the right to respect for private and family life. In the run-up to the meeting, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer and Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen published a joint letter urging other EU governments to go further in cracking down on migration, saying that, quote, the current asylum framework was created for another era. In a world with mass mobility, yesterday's answers do not work. Speaking to The Guardian, Michael Oflati, the Council of Europe's Commissioner for Human Rights, said that Europe's hardline governments risk creating a, quote, hierarchy of people as they seek to address migration by curbing fundamental rights. In a bizarre feeling twist, as all this was happening, I was in The Hague, where in the Peace Palace, home of the International Court of Justice, the Dutch Foreign Ministry was honouring international human rights defenders at the annual Tulip Awards. After presenting the award, which comes with a €50,000 prize, the Netherlands' human rights ambassador, Wim Geerts, gave this response to the day's events over in Strasbourg.
Throughout the process for us, for the Netherlands, you know, we will act in full respect of the European Convention on Human Rights and the independence of the court. To us, that's really crucial. I think the European Convention is still a very important document, and there's this one specific element that is under discussion now because of the migration challenges, and I understand why that's the case. But at, you know, having said that, we should also keep in mind that we will never interfere with the independence of the court, and not, you know, act in violation of the European Convention on Human Rights.
In The Hague, at least, December 10th was about celebrating human rights, not questioning them.
Human rights has been at the core of our foreign policy for many, many years. The tulip is a fragile flower, and human rights are also fragile. So it's a very fitting symbol. The tulip is also something very strongly connected to the Netherlands. So we've had this tradition now for 17 years, and it's an important occasion to highlight an individual or an organization and the work that they do.
The ultimate winner of the Tulip Award was Ayin Network, a Sudanese media collective taking unimaginable risks in order to report the truth about a deadly conflict in which over 150,000 people have already died, provoking what the UN has said is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 25 million people facing extreme levels of hunger.
Well, we have an independent jury, so they looked at all the 10 nominees, came up with a list of three finalists, and then on the basis of a number of criteria, the choice was made for Ayin Network from Sudan. And what Ayin Network, the winner, does is to document, to collect stories, to make sure that the Sudanese people get correct information, and also to work with the international community to make sure that the word goes out and that people hear about what's really going on.
Of the nine other nominees, two were from Europe. Christina Kitt, founder and chair of JurFem, a Ukrainian network of women lawyers committed to protecting victims of gender-based and conflict-related sexual violence. Also from Hungary.
My name is Vicky. I'm from Hungary and I'm the president of Budapest Pride.
This year's Budapest Pride, you may remember, saw thousands of people take to the streets in defiance of the Hungarian government's ban. A triumph of organising and also of communication. Here's Vicky Radvani again.
In mobilization point of view, very important for us is to deeply understand the context, to understand the historical context we are in, to understand that this is about everybody's rights to freedom of assembly. And this is how we built our campaign. We were talking to the people that we are standing up for every Hungarian. The question is not if you like pride marches or not. The question is, would you like the government to ban demonstrations they don't like politically?
And it's a message that resonated, even in the face of intimidation.
You know, when the Prime Minister announces that don't even try organizing a Pride March, that will scare a lot of people. Also, during this time, it was the first half of 2025, the Prime Minister of Hungary was launching like a full-scale attack against independent civil society and independent media channels. He called this the big spring cleaning, and they wanted to put forward a law which is very, very similar to the famous Russian type foreign agent laws, listing the organization they think that are, I don't know, threatening Hungary's sovereignty or something, and making it almost impossible to win international grants or to fundraise from other countries, including EU grants. They wanted to cut down on the grants organizations win in an open competition from, you know, from the European Commission, which is, you know, how can be EU funding foreign funding if we are inside the EU? But, you know, these logical problems don't always bother authoritarians. So it was very, very scary times. We didn't know what to expect.
The risks of organising in Hungary are not to be underestimated. Not long before we spoke, Vicky had received news that Giza Buzash-Habel, organiser of a pride march in the provincial town of Pécs, had been placed under investigation and was facing potential criminal charges.
Giza, who's the director of Diverse Youth Network, the organiser of Pécs Pride, made the very conscious and brave choice many Hungarians had to make this year, and he went ahead and organized the fifth Pécs Pride, which was a huge success. But 2 weeks after the Pride, He was asked to go to the police station for questioning, they took his photos, they took his statements. A few weeks after that, the local police leaked it to the propaganda media that they are advising the prosecutor to raise criminal charges against him. So I think if there is like one message for our listeners to put into perspective, is if we want to live in a European Union when somebody could go to jail for organizing a pride march.
And Vicky Radvani had a message for the European Commission too.
Hungary is usually viewed by other autocrats as kind of like a pilot program. So our message is for the European Commission to start an infringement procedure about the Pride ban in Hungary and ask the Court of Justice of the EU to immediately suspend the law. The European Commission has all the tools and the mandate to do that, but we've been just waiting for the Commission to make that step for almost 9 months. So I think it is time.
Vicky Radvani, president of Budapest Pride, talking to me in The Hague on December 10th, the 77th anniversary of the UN's adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And staying with weighty anniversaries, December 14th marks 30 years since the signing of the Dayton Accords, which ended the Bosnian War. To mark the occasion, DW Europe's video editor, Lavinia Pitu, put together a handy explainer guide to Dayton. And when we saw it, we found it so helpful that we jumped right in and asked Lavinia to produce an audio version for us too.
30 years ago, on December 14th, 1995, the Dayton Peace Agreement, also known as the Dayton Accords, was signed at a ceremony in Paris. It brought an end to the Bosnian War, one of the bloodiest conflicts in Europe since World War II. Here's Asim Mojkic, professor of philosophy at the University of Sarajevo, speaking on the importance of the agreement.
When we see what is happening in Ukraine, when we see what happened in Gaza, peace is really the first and basic condition for us to be able to achieve anything in life. Indeed, considering this, I have to give credit to the authors of the Dayton Peace Agreement, because they brought peace.
But what is the Dayton Peace Agreement and how was it reached? In the midst of the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, Bosnia and Herzegovina, a republic made up of ethnic Bosniaks, that's Bosnian Muslims, Serbs and Croats, declared independence on March 3rd, 1992. War broke out almost immediately. The ensuing conflict was brutal and complex. Bosnian Serb forces, which were backed by neighbouring Serbia, sought to create ethnically homogeneous territories, while the Bosniaks and Bosnian Croats fought to defend their own areas. In the 3 years that followed, over 100,000 people were killed and around 2 million displaced, nearly half of the country's population. The turning point of the war came in early July 1995 in the small eastern Bosnian town of Srebrenica. The UN had declared the town a safe area, which meant that thousands of Bosniaks flocked there in search of refuge. Over the course of just a few days, Bosnian Serb troops killed more than 8,000 Bosniak men and boys in what international courts later ruled was a genocide. The massacre shocked the world. It also exposed the shortcomings of the international peacekeeping forces in Bosnia and pushed Western governments to take action. Soon after Srebrenica, NATO, supported by the ground operations of the United Nations Protection Force, launched airstrikes against the Bosnian Serb positions. The offensive led to the leaders of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia and Serbia agreeing to meet for peace negotiations at a U.S. military base in Dayton, Ohio.
The parties have pledged to cooperate fully with a NATO-led peace implementation force and to ensure the safety of its personnel.
This is what Warren Christopher, the U.S. Secretary of State back then, said after the meeting. The agreement that ended the Bosnian War was reached in Dayton on November 21st and formally signed in Paris on December 14, 1995. The agreement, accepted by all parties, stipulated that Bosnia and Herzegovina would be made up of two entities: the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is mostly inhabited by Bosniaks and Bosnian Croats, and Republika Srpska, which is predominantly populated by Bosnian Serbs. But now, 30 years on, many think the situation hasn't really improved. Anto Matucic and Diana Rodelias, two citizens, put it like this.
Unfortunately, in our country, 30 years after Dayton, the situation has not improved at all. On the contrary, it's even worse than it was. Many young people have emigrated. Entire families have left these areas due to the economic situation.
We got peace, but in terms of the economy, we have not progressed at all. I'm afraid that for this reason, a large number of young people simply keep leaving our city, seeking a better life in another country.
30 years after Dayton, there is still peace in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But while the highly complex political system created by the agreement stopped hostilities, it didn't put an end to ethnic divisions and separatist tendencies or allow the country to truly prosper. The country's economy is currently one of the weakest in Europe, and its high rate of unemployment is a major problem. Bosnia and Herzegovina is keen to join the European Union, but significant reforms will have to be introduced before accession becomes a reality. In short, while peace prevails, Bosnia and Herzegovina is still searching for a way to overcome the bitter divisions created by the war and move forward in prosperity.
And we will be linking to the video version of Lavinia Pitu's Dayton Accords Explainer in our show notes. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
When headlines get louder, we go deeper.
Say hello to Berlin Briefing,
your guide to Germany's impact on the world. Between East and West, autocrats and democrats, Germany's whole system is under stress.
Pressure from all sides.
And the world around Germany is getting more dangerous.
Is democracy glitching? Too much noise? Too little clarity?
We decode what it means for you.
From Berlin to right where you are.
It's all in Berlin Briefing on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
And now it is time for the next installment of Laura Kabelka's Age is Just a Number series, highlighting young changemakers from across the continent. This week, we hear from Nabil Khan, a medical student from the UK. At just 22 years old, she is the founder of the non-profit Skin for All, a website making information on skin conditions across diverse skin tones more accessible.
Skin for All is my non-for-profit. I started it on my own 3 years ago, literally just in my bedroom, really. And it was a response to this feeling of helplessness. You know, society is going in a certain direction that isn't, you know, particularly positive.
Hundreds of thousands of people in England are not getting tests for killer diseases because of widespread delays.
Health Secretary accused of chaotic and incoherent approach to NHS reform.
Just 21% said they were satisfied with the NHS in 2024, with waiting times and staff shortages the biggest concerns.
Resident doctors in England went on 5 days strike in their 13th walkout since March 2023.
It was a response to the COVID-19 pandemic and the health inequalities that we saw there, and just how horrific it actually was for patient experience. And, you know, you had the pandemic statistics, you had the disproportionate amount of Black and ethnic minority staff members dying in the NHS. I couldn't really stand by and just say, that's okay, we'll let inequalities be inequalities. I needed to make a difference. And so that's why I created the website, to create a platform for people to feel seen, heard and respected within medicine, and in particular for Black and brown communities in the UK. I saw it in person, you know, as a medical student, but just as a person who uses the NHS, you see that need every single day with the statistics that you see on the news, with the stories you hear from family and friends about the inequalities or the racism that they face when they interact with medical systems. I heard a particularly emotive story about a woman who was constantly undermined. She was constantly told that she didn't have a diagnosis, which she herself had self-diagnosed and said, no, these are the symptoms. This is what I'm appearing with. But she was constantly undermined. And as a result, she was diagnosed really late. And she had unfortunately suffered the complications of that condition. And I think that's really tragic because medicine is all about humans. And if you can't create a service that's for everyone and that represents everyone, what's the point? It took me, I think it was 3 months, to complete the website, well, the first draft of the website. And I just wanted to be that platform for change. And I wanted to be that, you know, that platform which people could go to and talk to their friends about, saying, you know, have you seen this image? This is exactly what my skin conditions looks like. And so the pictures were a combination of pictures I had taken myself and pictures from patient websites, such as the NHS, such as Dermnet, and another incredible platform, Mind the Gap, which was created by Malone Mukwende, who is another UK medic. He spent time creating a book on black and brown skin as well. And so some of the images are from there. But it's been an amalgamation of different types of resources, different types of platforms to create this comprehensive picture of what health can look like in diverse communities. If you just press on read more or you press a certain condition, what I wanted to focus on was the different elements of a case. And so I focused on things like epidemiology, so essentially how prevalent is that condition. I focus on things like risk factors, if you have potential risk factors that could lead to you having that condition more than others, and things like management. And all of these components aren't meant to replace medical advice. Obviously, I'd say go and, you know, consult your doctor if you are concerned. But it's one of those platforms that just provides education just to make you feel a bit more confident if in a diagnosis, or make you feel a bit more confident in standing up for yourself in healthcare. This is something I'm passionate about, and this is something that makes me happy when I do see the results of it. So it doesn't seem like extra work for me. Thankfully, it's led me to attend some incredible events, such as the One Young World Summit in Munich. But I've also been to the States. So I went to Washington, D.C., and I spoke to the American Medical Student Association, where I received the Racial Justice in Medicine Award. And I was the first British student to ever win it. So that was an incredible feat. And again, a testament to the fact that this isn't just a national issue, it's an international issue, and that demand is still there. It's so, so important as a young person that you understand that your voice matters, and that you, even though you're not the most experienced person in the room, you haven't got years and years of being in a certain industry. You have lived experience, and no one can take that away from you. At this summit, I've literally just gone up to people and said, hi, this is me. How can we work together? And, you know, for a lot of people, they might think, oh, that's a bit strange. Why would you do that? But then it's about having the audacity to make your presence known and make your space as wide as possible and make it as sustainable as possible and leave that legacy.
Nabil Khan, founder of Skin for All, a website tackling medical inequality, one dermatological picture at a time. Our Age is Just a Number series is recorded and produced by Lara Kabelka. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster, and goodbye again. Why? Well, because one of my favourite DW podcast duos are back, and we're going to be handing over the second part of the programme to them so that you can get a taste for what they're offering this time. Business journalists Andreas Becker and Nico Martin were the team behind DW's Cannabis Cowboys investigative podcast, which is still available, by the way. And now they have set their sights on something bigger, perhaps even the biggest question of all for Germans right now. Namely, why does it feel as though everything in Germany's once mighty economy is going downhill? Their podcast is called Delayland, and almost inevitably, they're beginning with trains.
Once upon a time, there was a country whose people took great pride in being punctual, extremely punctual. When they made an appointment for 10:30, they meant 10:30. Not 10:31, not 10:32, but 10:30. That country was Germany. And for a long time, the German railway system was a model of punctuality. Trains were on time, period. The conductor who checked the tickets might have been rude, and the coffee in the train restaurant might have tasted terrible. But the train was always on time.
Delayed a day by about 40 minutes. We apologize for any inconvenience.
Alas, no more. Those days are over.
This is Germany like you've never heard it before. Once the country was a paragon of efficiency and punctuality. German engineering on the Autobahn, industry, innovation, digitalization, and good, honest business.
These days, Germany is another word for dysfunction and delays. German stereotypes used to smack off the truth. Trains on time, true. No delays because everything works, true.
Now, the magic is gone. Trains are delayed, German cars don't sell, and the speed of the internet is a joke. Or so it seems.
We want to find out what happened and why. I'm Nicolas Martin.
I'm Andreas Becker. And this is
Delayland. Germany and the missing magic. Brought to you by DW.
Episode 1, the train dilemma, to be or not to be on time.
Now we're here at Cologne Central Station, and let's see if Deutsche Bahn is on time, no?
Yeah, I would love the train to be on time. And because basically, and this is a confession we have to make early in this podcast, I think we can say we both love traveling by train.
Oh yeah, if everything runs smoothly, it's a perfect way to travel. But you bought a car.
I did, and that's another confession. I bought a car because for the longest time I've been fine with public transportation, but with commuting to work, with visiting friends and family regularly, I had the feeling it was becoming too much.
You needed a car because of the delays and the cancellations?
Yeah, they used to be the exception, but have become the norm.
Okay, having a car is your confession. My confession actually is that there were times when I was proud of Deutsche Bahn.
Proud?
Yes, you could sit down, you were on time, you had this very nice trains, and it was just such a smooth way of traveling through Germany.
Like this feeling that the national train system is great.
Yeah. You never had that feeling?
I wouldn't call it pride, but maybe something like that.
So what do you mean?
Our train's coming.
It's on time, yeah.
So, Andreas, what did you mean when you said you felt something close to pride but not quite when thinking about Deutsche Bahn?
Well, ages ago, I spent some time in Mumbai in India. That's a city of 20 million people, like more than twice as big as New York City. And I had to go one day to the city center, but I stayed in the suburbs, so I had to take a train, the same train that local commuters take. And when that
train arrived, I just froze because it was so full I didn't even know what to do.
Oh yeah, I've seen videos of Indian trains with people hanging on the handles near the open doors.
It was completely crazy. I just, nobody got off at my stop, and lots of new people got on, and I just stood there and let the train pass. And afterwards, a new train came, same story, another train, same story. I think I must have let pass 3 or 4 trains until I finally got the courage to squeeze myself in.
So that was the moment you felt pride?
I was completely proud of myself that I managed to get in there. But I also had to think about trains back in Germany, because for me, when I was in this Indian train, I thought like, what a luxury, what comfort.
Sounds like a feeling of superiority to me.
Maybe it was. But since my experience in Mumbai, when I came back to Germany, I've many times been in German trains that were as full, air conditioning broken, somebody's arm in my face, sweating and being late. And every time I thought like, oh, this feels very much like Mumbai to me. And there are Indians who know the commuter trains in Mumbai and think that riding German trains is actually worse. Our colleague Srishti Pal, for example.
Before coming to Germany, I was traveling by Mumbai local trains. So people every morning, they fight the battle of life and death to cram themselves into the trains, and they hang out of containers, literally. So when I came to Germany, I was very happy. Deutsche Bahn might be, you know, I won't have to struggle. I won't have to shove people, elbow them out of my way to get into the trains. That is partly true in some cities. But if you see rush hour in Frankfurt or Cologne, it's the same as a Mumbai local train, except the doors close. I thought Germany was a global north country. It is a global north country. But Deutsche Bahn is from global south.
The railroad has been a symbol of pride in Germany ever since the first train connection in 1835. The railway system grew quickly, and by the early 1920s, the Deutsche Reichsbahn, as it was called then, was the country's largest employer, with more than 1 million workers.
As old news reports and documentaries show, the train technology also became a showcase for German engineering. Back in the 1930s,
aus flinkendem Stahl,
gleaming steel holds the world's fastest machine together.
Lokomotive der Welt zusammen.
Or in the 1990s, when the high-speed ICE trains were introduced.
The high-speed intercity express represents the beginning of a new era of train travel for the newly merged German rail network. The intercity express combines speed with comfort. This is the future of rail travel.
Today, there's neither glamour nor pride in the German train system, just a general sense of frustration.
Even by its own standards, punctuality has plummeted, especially if you travel longer distances. These days, nearly 40% of trains are late. Compared to other European countries, German long-distance trains are among the worst when it comes to punctuality.
And what about the trains that commuters use to go to work or school or university, the regional trains?
That's a bit complicated. For long-distance trains, Deutsche Bahn pretty much has a monopoly. But when it comes to regional trains and cargo, there are hundreds of private operators as well. On paper, punctuality for regional trains looks better than for the long-distance ones. But it really depends on where you look. In densely populated urban centers like around Cologne or Frankfurt, rush hour can be a nightmare, regardless of the train operator.
We both commute, and we definitely know how that's like.
As do millions of other people in Germany who rely on trains. It's frustrating.
It's like when you're going to a casino and you gamble and you're hoping that you're on time. In rush hour, there's absolutely no guarantee at all that you're getting there in any reasonable time.
This is Tyler Bosselmann, a German 20-something with U.S. roots. He's not another frustrated passenger, but a train driver. Tyler has been driving regional trains for about 5 years, mostly between Heidelberg and Frankfurt, two major centers around the middle and south of the country. Tyler agreed to let us ride with him in the cockpit of the train. We had hoped that would allow us to witness the horrors of rush hour traffic firsthand.
But then, perhaps untypically, Deutsche Bahn sprang into action and intervened.
They said they had safety concerns, that our presence and our questions would distract Tyler, the driver. So they installed a second driver as backup.
It also seemed that DB had concerns about the optics of our conversation, how it would make them look. So they insisted a media officer accompany us as well.
And all that created a scheduling problem. But as luck would have it, or not, Deutsche Bahn picked a time slot with ideal conditions. It was right in the middle of school holidays, around lunchtime, and far away from any big city traffic. The train was nearly empty too.
We felt they wanted us to experience a picture postcard version of train travel in Germany. And Tyler seemed to agree.
Yeah, this is a quite smooth day we're going to have here. For your perspective, you're basically getting an ideal state right now. Yeah.
But even the best PR efforts cannot block out the reality that frustration runs high among train drivers.
Someone, and it was not Tyler, has scratched something about Deutsche Bahn into the plastic of the train's dashboard.
Yeah, I don't want to really pronounce that. So, yeah, somebody with too much free time and a key. So,
the jagged letters are coarse and clearly visible. DB is shit.
In recent years, strikes by the powerful train drivers' union have become quite common. The train drivers are demanding higher pay and better working conditions. They say, among other things, that their exhausting schedules do not allow them to rest enough and that frequent train delays lead to massive overtime.
Deutsche Bahn's other staff, from those in the control centers to service personnel to conductors and waiters in train restaurants, also have a long list of grievances. They are organized in a different union, and they also go on strike from time to time.
DB's troubles have made international headlines too. Like during the European Football Championship in the summer of 2024, which Germany hosted, the New York Times ran a myth-busting piece about our trains.
Euro 2024 and German efficiency. Forget everything you thought you knew.
During our ride with Tyler, everything went according to plan. No delays, no crowds, not even bad weather. But even then, signs of Deutsche Bahn's decline were visible. As we passed the steel bridge, Tyler pointed to some old abandoned tracks.
You can actually see the second track that was used to be in service here, but of course, you know, it's been quite a while. Therefore, the bridge they have replaced here is also only made for one track. This all used to be a double track. You could have way more and higher volume of traffic running around here if you just invested in a few euros into this replacement track.
But the one-track system is just a symptom. The real problem is a consistent lack of investment in infrastructure. According to a report by the German Ministry of Transport, half of the country's tracks are in mediocre, poor or deficient condition and need fixing. A fifth of the infrastructure needs to be replaced in the medium term, and some of it immediately. Some signal boxes are over 100 years old.
Maintenance requires constant care and repair. That costs money. But for decades, Deutsche Bahn has invested less money in maintenance than many other European countries. In 2023, it just spent over 100 euros per capita. That is, for each person in the country. Austria, as a comparison, invested 3 times as much, and Switzerland 4 times as much.
Those 100 euros per capita that Germany spends, that is an improvement on a decade ago when it spent half as much.
All in all, in the past 30 years, Deutsche Bahn has failed to keep its infrastructure in shape. And now it's crumbling.
At the same time, the German railway network has shrunk. But traffic has grown, with a lot more people having to commute for work these days.
More traffic on a shrinking network that is falling apart. That, in essence, is Deutsche Bahn's problem.
But this decay hasn't come overnight. Today's problems have their root in what happened after East and West Germany reunited in 1990.
sind wir jetzt hier?
Das ist jetzt das Bahnhofsgebäude.
That's Jens Kaminski welcoming us into his office at a small train station near Lake Constance in the south of Germany.
Hier haben die Mitarbeiter Dienstbeginn und Dienstende.
Like Tyler, Jens is a train driver and a union member. Unlike Tyler, he's been doing it so long, 30 years, that he can remember the times when punctual trains were the rule, not the exception.
Jens told us he and his colleagues took great pride in working for the National Railway and were well respected by the general public. But no more.
Wenn man früher durchs Dorf gegangen ist, dann ist man gegrüßt worden.
Back then, when you used to walk through the village, you'd be greeted like a fireman, like a hero. Today, it's more like, oh, he's a train driver. Today, you're nothing.
Heute ist man nichts.
Jens said back then, being on time was the top priority. Expressions like as punctual as a train were used in everyday German language. Pünktlich wie die Bahn. And railway workers said the timetable is law.
Es war anders. Im Baby zum Beispiel.
Things were different back then. There were 12 people on standby at the depot. They would just sit there, and if something happened, if a train broke down or something else, they would go and fix it. No problem. Nowadays, we don't have standby crews anymore. Too expensive.
Heutzutage haben wir keine Bereitschaftsleute mehr. Zu teuer.
Listening to Jens talk about the way things were, it feels like this story is about even more than just failing infrastructure or frustration that you can't rely on German punctuality anymore. It's as if Deutsche Bahn is Germany, that its decay is a symptom of a much deeper malaise.
And at least some of this malaise is connected to Germany's reunification in 1990. There are some interesting parallels between the history of Deutsche Bahn and the biography of Jens Kaminski. He was born near Dresden in the former East Germany. The year he started his career as a train driver, 1994, was also the year that the rail companies of East and West Germany merged to form a newly incorporated Deutsche Bahn AG.
1994 was just 4 years after German reunification, after the fall of communism. It was as though the free market spirit of capitalism had won over communism.
Yeah, Deutsche Bahn AG was meant to reflect all that. Capitalism over communism, West Germany taking over East Germany. AG, the letters A and G in English, stands for Stock Corporation in German. The plan was to transform the National Railroad Company into a competitive and profitable enterprise that would eventually go public on the stock market.
The year before the merger, the Western and the Eastern train companies employed almost 500,000 people, but ran a massive deficit, not exactly attractive for investors.
So what followed was a period of drastic cost-cutting and downsizing. Deutsche Bahn stopped investing in infrastructure, reduced its network and its workforce, all that in a bid to become attractive to investors.
And less attractive to the public.
Ja, das ist dann die Zeit gewesen, wo der richtige Stellenabbau begonnen hat.
That was the time when the real job cuts began. Tracks were closed down, even those needed to overtake trains. It was radical, a real change. You could feel it everywhere.
Ja, das hat sich voll bemerkbar gemacht.
So, how does Deutsche Bahn look today as a company?
At first glance, Deutsche Bahn looks pretty impressive. It generated roughly 27 billion euros in revenue last year. But Deutsche Bahn is not profitable. It lost almost 2 billion euros in 2024.
And most importantly, even though Deutsche Bahn is organized like a stock corporation, it has never gone public. The German government is the only shareholder.
So, who is ultimately responsible for the mess that Deutsche Bahn is in? Is it the CEO and his management team? Jens Kaminski, our train driver, doubts that.
Ich darf das gar nicht sagen. Ich finde,
I shouldn't even say this. But I think they're just puppets of the government. They get instructions on how the railway should be run or what the railway must do, and it's all controlled from Berlin.
That's not just the personal opinion of a union member. His assessment is shared by Germany's Federal Court of Audit. The auditor's job is to check how the government spends the taxpayers' money and to sound the alarm if they see cause for concern.
And boy, have they sounded the alarm. More than once, actually. The auditors regularly check on Deutsche Bahn. In their most recent report, they did not mince words.
For three decades, the federal government has failed to address key railway policy issues.
According to the auditors, the government failed to develop a clear plan for the train company, it failed to define clear goals, and it failed to exert its influence as the company's only shareholder.
The result, according to the auditors' report,
Deutsche Bahn has long been failing to meet customer expectations for punctuality and reliability. Deutsche Bahn is in constant crisis and in need of reform.
The report also reminds the government of its constitutional obligation. The German constitution, or basic law, defines railway infrastructure and transport as public goods. The government has the duty to ensure that trains run properly and people can travel.
Other governments take this obligation much more seriously. Switzerland, for example. Yes, the country is much smaller, but it also has a complex rail system and often challenging weather conditions. Still, it manages to maintain a punctuality rate of over 90%.
So, Nico, you've experienced that the Swiss take punctuality very serious and they are willing to take drastic measures to make sure their trains are on time.
Oh, yes, I did.
What happened?
Well, I was traveling from Germany to Switzerland with my kids. It was summer, it was a super hot day, and we were passing through Germany, and during the ride, our train had already accumulated more than 1 hour of delay. And when we got to the Swiss border, to the last station before the Swiss border, we were forced to get out.
What do you mean, forced to get out?
Well, we had no choice. The train stopped and we were told to get out. We were told that the Swiss wouldn't let the train in because it was massively late.
Whoa, that was like the Swiss lesson in punctuality? Or what?
Yes. Every train coming from Germany with more than 15 minutes delay risks being denied entry into Switzerland.
Whoa, they do take this serious, huh?
Yes.
Swiss style. It's somewhat ironic that Switzerland is used as a positive example when it comes to trains. Because back in the 1990s, their national train company was in bad shape. Functional, but too expensive, too stolid, too bureaucratic.
In 1999, a few years after the Germans, the Swiss started to reform their railway company and chose a similar course. They turned their railway company into a private corporation with a single shareholder, the government.
But here's the key difference. The Swiss knew what they wanted from their railway company and did not change strategy every few years.
It boils down to how a country answers this question. Should a train system be run like a company that generates profits? Yes or no?
The Germans said yes, and the Swiss said no. Because the Swiss see their national train company as a public service provider. That's what Peter Füglisthaler told German broadcaster WDR. Until his retirement in 2024, Füglisthaler was the top supervisor of the Swiss railroad company.
A railway infrastructure isn't meant to generate profit. Its goal is to provide capacity and punctuality, benefits for everyone. It requires a different management approach, one focused on reliability. In the end, it's all about the money, how many billions are allocated to maintain and expand the rail network. Without money, it doesn't work. Germany is investing much less in its railway than Switzerland. But if you invest much less, you cannot expect the same quality.
So it's not just that Germany denied there was a problem or that it's delayed dealing with it. The German government wanted something different from its national infrastructure than the Swiss. Profit.
Tyler, the young train driver, thinks there's another problem lurking below. He told us the decline of Deutsche Bahn had a lot to do with our love for cars.
Germany is a car country. Germany has always been a heavy car industry country, and that's why the focus is always, at the end of the day, putting more money into roads and car infrastructure or truck infrastructure than our train system. And it shows off. People love our highways. They love our Autobahn. They want to go with no speed limit down the road and have, you know, a great time. If a train comes late, who cares, you know? I mean, you get there. Just later.
Germany is indeed a car country. Over the past 30 years, the government has invested twice as much in streets and Autobahns than in railroad infrastructure. A study concluded, German policy is still fully focused on the car.
So for train travelers, it's been downhill for decades. And they are not only frustrated with the train company, but with successive German governments and their politics.
The journalist Arno Luik published a book about Deutsche Bahn and how it's falling to bits. Here's a quote from the book.
Every dilapidated train station, and there are thousands, is a symbol for the state of the entire country. Anyone waiting in the cold in these shabby and run-down places, waiting for trains that might never arrive, has a very real sense of what those in power at the National Rail Operator and in politics in Berlin think of them. Alarmingly little. From there, it's only a short step to a general disenchantment with politics, and the cry, "You piss me off, all of you, you politicians in Berlin, every last one of you."
But amid all the frustration, some people are finding ways to cope with these challenges.
Perhaps it's just his North American background coming through, but Tyler, the young train driver, is an optimist. He thinks DB will be fixed.
People that commute a lot with train, they have more patience, and when people ask them, how come you're so calm and not all raged up? Dude, I travel with a train all the time. I know how bad it can be. This is nothing, you know? So in a sense of that, I think people take something positive with them when they travel with us. So there's always a bright side, as they say, right? There's always a bright side.
Let's break into song here.
So what do you think, Andreas? Will Deutsche Bahn ever be fixed?
I sure hope so, because I really like train traveling. But part of me thinks it depends on whether we are able to accept that we made mistakes and learn from others and then take action.
Yeah, I wonder why Deutsche Bahn didn't do it like the Swiss.
But at least something seems to be changing now. The country has taken on massive new debt to invest in infrastructure, including trains and tracks and signals and stations.
Billions are poured into infrastructure right now. But it's just like so much time was lost. The country seemed to be in denial and the problems just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Huh. And in our next episode, denial and delay are important factors too.
In episode 2 of Delayland, we look at Germany's car industry.
I'm shaking. I'm okay, but I survived. I'm proud.
Delayland from Andreas Becker, Nico Martin and their team is available wherever you get your podcasts. All 4 episodes are out, so feel free to binge listen and revel in the misfortune of others. Now, if only there were a German word for that. That's it for today. Inside Europe was produced by Laura Kabelka and me, Kate Laycock. Our sound engineer was Natalie Wittmann. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.